Hey folks, and tonight's episode is brought to you by YesPleaseVintage.com. If you're in the States and a fan of vintage and upcycled housewares and clothing, give YesPleaseVintage.com a check for clothing, jewelry, homeware, and some really awesome finds. So go check them out now at YesPleaseVintage.com. And currently, if you spend over $60, you get free shipping on all orders. Hello, welcome to the Asian Cinema Film Club. I'm your host, as always, Edward Jones, and joining me, of course, is my co-host, the Professor, Mr. Stephen Palmer.
Hi there.
Tonight, we are going to be looking at Sumo Do, Sumo Don't, from 1992, as a college senior is blackmailed by his professor into joining the school's sumo team, and aided by a group of misfits, must band together to save their sumo club. But before we get into that, it's time to ask what you've been watching. And Stephen, what's been holding your interest since the last episode?
I was going to struggle with this because I've had quite a busy week for reasons. I haven't actually been able to watch much TV, mostly because most of my flat is in my living room at the moment because I'm having it repainted. So getting access to media has been hard. But today I was able to do a little catch up. I think you're probably aware of some of the Detective D movies. So Choi Hark did one a few years ago, Detective D and I think it's a Secret Flame or something like that, with Andy Lau in the Detective D role. So basically, Detective D is this, he's a sort of semi-historical figure that lots of people have written stories about him. He's like the Chinese Sherlock Holmes, but yeah, Set in period China. And actually sort of became popular because a Dutchman wrote a load of stories about the character, and people still write today. There's a sort of big literary movement about it. And like I say, Choi Hark did I want to say three movies, maybe four, and he did a young Detective D movie. Anyway, I quite like them. I quite like that. But they're apart from the first three are very much with Andy Lau, and they're very much a sort of a grown-up D at the end of his life sort of thing, you know, super experienced. The young Detective D one had Mark Chow, I think, a sort of Taiwanese sort of action guy in it, which was fine. Anyway, I was trawling the interwebs, as one does, and I found a whole bunch of other modern Detective D movies starring people I've never heard of, directed by people I've never heard of. And because I didn't have much time, and one of them was only an hour and a half long, I thought I'd check it out. So it goes under the name of D. Renji and the Fire Unicorn. So Detective D and the Fire Unicorn, or I think it probably should be Fire Kirin or Kirin, because you don't have unicorns in Chinese mythology. That's a very much a Western thing, but you do have a thing called a Kirin, which is a sort of horned horse deer thing, which is definitely what's on the screen. Anyway, so we're in this town, Chang'an, and this is a young Detective D. He's going to the town to take up a role as like a deputy inspector, sort of deputy policeman, and he gets involved and in this sort of street thing where this fiery creature appears, and so this is basically a world where magic exists as well as super detective work. You know, he's the sort of detective that goes, you used to be in the Vietnam War, and someone's like, well, how would you know that? Well, he wouldn't say the Vietnam War, obviously, because of time, but, you know, so that's because the way you limp is like this, and your inflection, the way you speak sounds like you've been in Saigon for a number of years, you know the kind of thing that they do. So it's a bit of that, but then there's all these CGI effects, there's all this kung fu stuff, or wire fu stuff going on, and I've got a bonus, mate, it's an hour and a half long, I thought it was going to be shit, right? I had a whale of a time with it. I don't know any of the characters, the actors in it. It's directed by a fella called Hui Tong, who, looking him up on Letterboxd, seems to have made four or five Detective D movies.
There's quite a few, isn't there? I mean, I'm just looking at them now, and there's like 17 Detective D movies, and the last time I checked, there was only three, so...
Yeah, I was really surprised. He seems to make them one year. But what's really surprising is, and I think this talks to just how advanced CGI and the Chinese sort of machine has gone. You know, it's the CGI effects, the special effects are great. You know, but this clearly, I cannot find another review of this film anywhere in the English language. It doesn't seem to, you know, normally you'll find, like, even on IMDb, someone's watched it. There's two other people who've watched it on Letterboxd, but they haven't made a review about it. Don't ask me where I found it, mate. But it was really good, and now makes me want to go and find more films by this Wee Tong. And he doesn't seem to concentrate. He seems to have different actors in every single one. And I know there's some of the ones on Letterboxd are like a Taiwanese TV show, so it's not all movies. But anyway, yeah, it's very much like the Detective D film. Basically, D comes in, and then he makes friends with another guy who's a bit of a swordsman, and he makes friends with a girl who's rather annoying, but she happens to be the daughter of his new boss. And I've got to say, the way it all spins out is like how all Detective D shows end, and that the bad guy is somebody who is pretty bloody obvious all along. But yeah, the special effects are great, the story's great. I really had a whale of a time. And you know, so often these movies sort of outstay their welcome. I'm reminded of there was a series of films called The Four, which was kind of like a Chinese period X-Men. I'm pretty certain our friend Anthony Wong was in them as well.
Okay.
But it's they're called The Four, and then The 4-2 and The 4-3, and that's very confusing. But they were trying to get that whole Detective D thing going on, but with the special effects and an all-star cast, and they just outstayed their welcome, and they were quite boring, and they just weren't interesting enough. Whereas this was, yeah, this is a charming little movie. However, I have no idea anybody who doesn't have access to certain bits of the internet will ever get to watch it. Hopefully, maybe someone from 88 Films is listening right now, and they'll say, oh, that's a good thing to go and plumb. There's the English subtitles and everything, so it's clearly got an audience somewhere. Anyway, I really enjoyed that. That's it, though. That's all I've watched this week. How about yourself?
For myself, I've been just mainly watching anime this week because my Funimation trial was coming to an end, and then I forgot to cancel it, so they've charged me for another month, so I'll be watching more anime in the coming month as well. But what I did focus on was finishing off what I thought was the complete series of Attack on Titan, only to get all the way to episode 89, I think it is, and thinking we're just building up in what I think is going to be this climactic final battle. It's an hour-long episode, this first final episode. And no, there is more to come. We have got more coming out this year as they continue to wrap it up. I think there's two more blocks of Attack on Titan to go. But just looking where this show has gone from where we started with these kids behind the wall and living in this land where you've got naked giants going around eating people, and how their walls get knocked down by these giant titans who've create chaos, and we see them join the scouts and become hardened veterans, and we get into like the final season, and then how these characters are developed, how we've got new special titans, and we find out who's behind those, and the whole scope of the show is just completely opened up. So we're in a completely different place by this final season than we are when we started the show. We think it's just this, the world that we see is like this complete world, and by the time we get to the final season, we find out that we've just been looking at this small portion of this world this whole time, and there's this huge canvas that we're now getting to explore with this final season. But yeah, it's got the usual sort of problems, really, with certain characters being overly mopey and melodramatic. But obviously, if you're an anime fan, you'll probably either dig that or share my sort of grievances with it. But I'm now up to date on Attack on Titan, so I can hang out with the kids now. All the cool, hip anime kids.
So has it ended, or is there more?
No, it's still going. It's, as I said, we end on a cliffhanger of the season. And there's actually a scene in this final season which felt very much like a throwback to, and I'm trying to remember which David Attenborough movie it was. Sorry, Richard Attenborough, not David Attenborough. David Attenborough is the nature guy. Richard Attenborough, the director of, and, you know, John Hammond from Jurassic Park. One of his war movies is a scene where a soldier like goes out the field and he sees all his fallen comrades, and he just sits there in this field bathed in the sunlight. And Attack on Titan has this scene where one of the main characters dies, and she goes out in this blaze of glory and she ends up in like being surrounded by her fallen comrades that we've seen die throughout the course of the show. And it felt like such a throwback to that scene from his film. And for the life of me, I can't remember which film it is now. I wouldn't say A Bridge Too Far, but I'm not sure if that's the right one. No idea either, Stephen?
I'm just thinking, which one's A Bridge Too Far?
It's the one with the bridge.
And it's too far, isn't it? I don't know.
It's one of those classic World War II movies. It's not, obviously, not Bridge Over Iroquois, and it's not Guns of Navarone, it's not Eagle's Dare.
Or The Eagle Has Landed.
No.
Or Force 10 from Navarone.
Battle of Britain, or Mosquito Squadron, or...
What's the word?
Or The Deadly Dozen. Or The Deadly Dozen 2, The Next Mission. It's none of those.
What was that one? Douglas Bader. I like that one. Where he loses his legs, but still can fly a Spitfire. Anyway, sorry. Go back to Attack on Titan.
Yes. So Attack on Titan, it basically, we are now facing like world apocalypse by the time we get into this final season. And it's, you know, it's fun. It's got, the action scenes are really fantastic in it. And I like it when it hits those action beats, but at the same time, when it hits those mopey melodramatic bits, you're like, just get on with it already. But it's been kind of nice to obviously see some of the like big questions being answered in the show, and it gives like satisfying conclusions to those. So that's been great. Obviously, in need of a new anime show, I've started Demon Slayer, which is obviously another of the big shows of the moment, that along with My Hero Academia. And I think, much like My Hero Academia, this is a sort of anime show that if you're not an anime fan, you could watch this and really enjoy it. Obviously, My Hero Academia is like X-Men meets Alan Moore's Top 10. And when you with Demon Slayer, it's basically a pop samurai anime with this young boy who returns home to find that his family have all been slaughtered by a demon, and his sister's been turned into a demon. But at the same time, she's retained part of her humanity. So he sets out on a quest to slay the demon that turned her, in turn becoming a demon slayer. So it's basically an excuse for lots of flashy powers and fun swordplay. And I'm 9 episodes into the 26 episode run of the first season. It is on Netflix, much like My Hero Academia, so you can check it out on there without having to get a subscription to Crunchyroll or Funimation. And I'm watching the dub and having a really, really fun time with it. So yeah, I can see why all the kids love this one.
That makes you one of the kids as well now.
We're even one of the hip kids now. I can hang out with them and with their...
Have you got a hipster beard? And
that's the thing, I'd be like...
And drinking espressos.
drinking IPAs, isn't it?
That's right, yeah.
I think they're more like... One Piece, and I'm still like 1,000 episodes behind on that one. So, yeah, that's my main thing at the moment. I'm going to also start the rebuild movies for Evangelion, because they've been sitting on the pile for way too long, and I need to start those now. I've obviously, on the previous episode, we talked about death and rebirth and the end of Evangelion, and how it basically like flip the bird to the fans by giving them the ending that they apparently wanted. So again, I'm still would love to hear anyone's thoughts on Evangelion. If you want to tell me what it is about the show you love, because I'd really be interested to see if it's like the whole 26 episode run, the whole run of that show that that you like, or whether it's just like that first bit before it gets into really weird and it's like last four episodes. So feel free to enlighten me.
On the Facebook page. Come and join us.
Indeed. Or you can hit us on Twitter and we're on Instagram. Or if that doesn't work for you, just hit us up on the email, which is acfilmclub@yahoo.com. Or just go on our website. It's asiancinemafilmclub.wordpress.com. And there you can use the contact us button to send us all your thoughts on Evangelion and anime and what we should be watching. And recommendations to the show, because that's always welcome as well. So on that note, a very brief wrap of what we've been watching, a lot of TV watching, and obviously discovering lots of Detective D from you, Stephen. So,
indeed, yeah, this could be a pattern. You hear for a few weeks. I found another Detective D film.
It's like movie that was released, that Russian movie that came out, and they were like promoting the scenes with Arnold Schwarzenegger and Jackie Chan. And they're just at the start, and it's got the guy from Lock, Stock.
Right, Jason Fleming.
Jason Fleming. He's made two of these movies in Russia, and he plays like a Detective D character.
Gotcha.
And the second one I remember being kind of excited, because I said it features Jackie Chan as the man in the iron mask. And they like send it like, this is Jackie Chan, Arnold Schwarzenegger movie. And it's really not. It's just the opening cameos. And it's this Jason Fleming character, where he's like, as I say, he's this Detective D character in like a mythical, in the same sort of fantastical version of the world.
Mm.
So,
I quite like Jason Fleming. I mean, he's no Jason Statham, but I'll check it out.
What's your favourite Jason Fleming performance then, Stephen, as the founder of the Jason Fleming fan club, clearly?
Well, I think Lock, Stock.
No, not is a safe it... one.
Well, no, I'm not a deep diver, but I don't hate him when he appears. He was in, I'm pretty certain he was in the Limehouse Golem as well, but that he's not a main thing in that. I'm pretty certain he was in that. I don't ever think of him as a lead actor.
Yeah.
He's just like this guy that's in a lot of British films, but has also turned up as third heavy in some American B movies as well.
He's in Deep Rising.
He is, yes.
Which was originally going to lead into an adaptation of King Kong, but the rights got really screwed up, and instead it went to Peter Jackson instead.
Now I'm going to go and have... Now, this is obscure even for us. Oh, it's spelt in a weird way, isn't it?
Which one are you looking for?
Jason Fleming.
Oh, okay. It should just come up automatically, though.
There's a Y. It's a Fleming Young. Right. Let's have a look. He's in Rob Roy. He was in Spice World the movie.
He wasn't in Spice World the movie.
Although you can't get that. There's no DVD release of that. That needs to be fixed. He's in From Hell. Yeah.
So it was Robbie Coltrane.
Yeah. He's in Mean Machine, which I think is the... I'm guessing that's the Vinnie Jones remake. Yeah. He's in League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. That's what I was thinking. He's Mr. Hyde in that, isn't he? He's in Layer Cake. He's in Seed of Chucky. That'll appeal to you. He's in Transporter 2. Yeah, that's what I mean. I can't think... Oh, he's in The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, apparently.
Gets around, clearly. He's also Kick-Ass as well.
He's in Kick-Ass, Social Network, although uncredited. Yes, anyway, I'll stop with this. We could do a whole podcast series. Is that the VIY movies?
Yes, that's the one.
Yes, he's made three of them.
Oh, right. There's a third one now.
There's a new one to be announced called Journey to India. The last one was called Journey to China.
Yes, and that's right.
Oh, I've got this VIY. I didn't know what it was.
You just bought it.
Yeah, well, it was one of those recommended, and I remember thinking, oh, I'll have a look. I've never watched it, but yeah, I do have VIY. Oh, okay. Welcome to our spin-off show, the Jason Fleming Experience.
You know, when we finally get around to launching the World Cinema Film Club, which we've long since talked about, then we can obviously cover these movies.
Yeah. Oh my word. Right. Anyway, let's get back to what we should be doing.
Indeed. It's time to fire up the projector now for tonight's feature presentation, Sumo Do, Sumo Don't. So Sumo Do, Sumo Don't, directed by Masayuki Suo, who Steven's a fan of because he did Shall We Dance?
Yeah, Shall We Dance, but actually I'm more of a fan of I Just Didn't Do It, which is a brilliant legal drama about a kid who gets caught groping on the subway. But it's actually a diss track against the Japanese legal system where everybody who gets arrested by the police is automatically guilty. That's how the Japanese, I think we've talked about this before. So it's a really fantastic film. Shall We Dance obviously did really well and had a Richard Gere Western remake. He also worked with Juzo Itami, who I've spoken about many times. So he did some work with him in the past, and he also did this. His first film was a Pinku film done in the style of Ozu, which is, it's not the most thrilling one. It's a by-the-numbers sex scene every 10 minutes. You don't see anything more than buttocks and boobs. I think there's a urophilia, if you're into that kind of thing, and but it's done with low camera angles, breaking the 180 rule, all this. It's visually very interesting. He's a director I like, but I've always wanted to watch this film, and I had it for a while, and so I'm really glad when you picked it up, because I suspected it's my cup of tea.
It's funny you should mention Richard Gere, because I saw an article the other day of why Richard Gere doesn't have a career anymore, and it came about because when he received an award, he was critical of China's
Tibet,
occupation of Tibet, and seeing as China fund everything now, this is why they won't he can't get a job doing anything anymore. It's
nothing to do with the gerbil.
I don't know what's going to happen. So you see, between him and Freddie Starr.
There was a big thing, wasn't there, that Richard Gere had a gerbil up his arse. But the whole Free Tibet movement. Richard Gere is very much at the front and centre, and now that
he's now at the front and centre of the unemployment line.
He must be getting on a bit, but I'm sure he's doing all right for money. I'm sure the residuals from Pretty Woman are doing him all right, and Officer and a Gentleman.
Well. Again, with Pretty Woman, I found out the guy who wrote Pretty Woman, his first film was Cannibal Women in the Avocado Jungle of Death.
With Bill Maher.
Exactly. And J.F. Lawton. And he would go on to write Under Siege 1 and 2 as well as DOA, the adaptation of the Dead or Alive games.
Yes, I knew that. Yes, I was because obviously the Pretty Woman script originally wasn't a frothy rom-com. It was a dark story about prostitutes and heroin, and which is why the other lady, whatever she's called,
Julie Roberts.
No, not Julie Roberts. Her friend in the film who has got a comedy heroin addiction in the Pretty Woman's a terrible movie. There's an episode of Lamb where I rant on that. it's a terrible movie. Even at the time, it was a terrible movie. But it's one anyway. So Jason Fleming and Richard Gere have infected the show this week.
Apparently so.
Let's talk about Sumo Do, Sumo Don't.
But yeah, Sumo Do, Sumo Don't. The film which comes with the tagline: a giant comedy with giant underpants. The film itself follows a college senior called Shuei, who is blackmailed by a professor into joining the school's sumo team, and he's aided by a group of misfits who must team together to defeat their rivals or face disgrace and the disbandment of their sumo club. This is a film which has been on my watch pile for a very long time. I first found out about it through Robin Bougie, who is the creator of the Cinema Sewer books, and he had a podcast for a very short period of time to tie in with the Cinema Sewer books. and the so the Cinema Sewer was a zine, and it was compiled into books by Fab Press. So you either know it's a book or you know it's a zine, and it's now no longer about. He drew it to a close, but he had a short-lived podcast, which I really wish he continued, because he really highlighted some fantastic films on there, such as like Street Gangs of Hong Kong, and Kids of Times Square. And this was one of the films that was brought up, and there was just something about the about how it was explained to me about these group of misfits like forming a sumo club, and the fact that none of them match up to the traditional physique of what you expect from a sumo wrestler, but because they're in the third tier of the leagues, that no one expects them to be big guys. They can be any sort of physique. They just obviously have to have this willingness to take part in a sumo competition. Stephen, had you seen this one before? Is this a first time watch for yourself?
No, it's a first time watch for me. Like you, though, it's been on my watch pile for a while, especially after I saw I Just Didn't Do It. And then knowing that it was a sort of a Japanese sports comedy, I was hoping it was going to be in the vein of things like Water Boys.
Yes.
Which is another excellent film by the director of Swing Girls. Again, Swing Girls, Water Boys, that kind of thing. You know, some plucky students do something that they wouldn't normally do and succeed against the odds. The classic sports movie. But there is a lot of Japanese comedies which have this thing. So I had fairly high hopes that I'd find it enjoyable. Did you recognise the shared actor between this and Swing Girls?
No, I did not. Who okay. is it?
So, the guy who is the long-term student who's been there for 8 years.
Right.
is his name. Aoki is played by Naoto Takanaka, who is the teacher in Swing Girls, and he's also the caretaker in Water Boys. He's in loads of films, but yes, this is just a few years before Swing Girls, and in this one he apparently is playing somebody who's about 20, and in a couple of years later in Swing Girls he's playing somebody who's an old teacher. So he's but yes, I thought, aha, it's him, because I love him. Well, not literally, but yes, always enjoy him. So yes, that's what I was expecting, a wacky comedy, and I think that's what I got.
Definitely. The film itself is noteworthy for being one of the few representations on film of sumo wrestling, which is very surprising for seeing how connected to Japan sumo wrestling is. You would have thought that this would have been a subject to more films, but this is one of the few films that it has looked at the sport. And certainly, I think your enjoyment of the film is going to really, I think it's going to really derive from how exciting you find sumo wrestling as a concept.
Really? I'm interested. I mean, the only time I've ever seen sumo wrestling on film is it You Only Live Twice?
Okay.
doesn't Sean Connery go to a sumo match for about 15 seconds?
He does. And I know The Rock's grandfather, Peter Malvea, got a job as got a credit as a stunt coordinator, because he was hired to do fight scenes with Connery. And he was like, they would just say, thought like, oh, the fight choreography was really boring, so he used his wrestling background to choreograph it, and they gave him this credit as a stunt coordinator on the film because of it. And Connery himself said to Movie, it's sort of like wrestling, like guys where people fake fight each other, and he's sort of like, yes, much like acting.
Classic. I mean, the thing about sumo, I will disagree with your statement about that, but okay, that's fine. We'll talk about that in a second. But I mean, I think the film itself almost points out that sumo wrestling is quite a niche sport in modern Japan. Well, this is a 1992 film, so it's not that modern, is it? But in its contemporary world, that sumo wrestling has really sort of, it isn't a sport of young people. It's a sport of, you know, they seem to have some very keen aficionados, people that used to be in sumo clubs and stuff like that, but it's not that popular. And they, you know, the point is made out that they don't really know all the rules to it. And we imagine I mean, I remember when it was on when Channel 4 here in the UK had some sport. They had kabaddi, which is the Indian like sport, and sumo wrestling. And we used to get all excited about Dump Truck. Do you remember him? And all, I don't know if you remember this. I remember
seeing it because it was on Four World Sports or something like
that's
that.
That's right.
Trans World Sport.
No, so they not only had it on Trans World Sport, they also had it like matches every week. It was like a digest program, but yeah. And it was in the era, I think, of some superstars like Dump Truck, and they all had wrestling type nicknames. But that was for like 2 years, maybe, tops. So I don't know anything about sumo wrestling, and to me, it's about great big guys in thongs.
Mawashis.
Mawashis, exactly. As again, it's brought up.
Which is one of the best jokes in this. The fact that the students, they're so ignorant of sumo and its training in it's, you know, the training, the customs, all these things are just sort of like, it's sort of like, isn't it just like a nappy? Isn't it a jockstrap? And this this poor guy, Aoki, who's like he's been there for 7 years. He's like the one guy keeping it together. And he keeps going, Mawashi. And then like when the female members comes in and she like criticizes it, and he just like mumbles to himself. He's like, Mawashi. And we see him like getting fitted for it, and he's all like, "It's crashing my testicles." He's like, "Have more fortitude."
Yes, there is a lot of that. But yes, I just think so. The reason I think you probably don't need to know is because most of the people in the film don't know anything about it, and I do think that it's one of the director's things is to poke at very Japanese culture. I mean, like I say, in Just to Do It, he's poking at the legal system. Here, he's poking at this sort of ritualized sport that, you know, when they have their first contest, the guy picks up the rice and throws it over the circle because he's seen them do that. And that the guy who's cleaning up goes, beginners don't do the ritual rice thing, you know, and there's just all these things we thought. There's salt, you're right, you're quite right.
I just don't want to be answering angry emails from like
sumo aficionados.
Sumo aficionados who've tuned into this episode because they want to hear some sumo talk, and they're talking about frying rice around.
But I just thought the point was that you didn't need to know, although there are things though, the like we'll get it when we talk to the plot, but like women aren't allowed in the circle.
No.
And although that becomes a big plot point, there is actually a little bit later on where you see one of the female characters try to go and help one of her stricken colleagues, and she stops because she's not allowed in the circle.
Oh yeah, that was really great.
Yeah, but so there's little, so it's having these little pokes at Japanese culture, which I kind of like. It's sort of saying this is a bit old fashioned, guys. However, I know you're a wrestling man. You know, I don't get sumo wrestling at all, especially when they're not behemoths of men who are like, I mean, I've seen lots of documentaries about sumo wrestling, and, you know, these guys are like monks, aren't they? And they're trained, and it's all about ritual and what they eat and how, and exactly how they train. And even the sport itself is very ritualized, and the things you do and don't do. And to an outsider, it's, well, it just looks like two fat blokes slapping each other over the face. But I don't know how you view sumo wrestling in the world of wrestling that you enjoy.
I have very little experience, as I said, with sumo wrestling as a whole. I understand the principle where it's like two guys who are like built like trucks charging at each other. But as the film obviously goes to point out, there's a lot more complexity to it. There's different, and it does a really good job of explaining the different rules of sumo in a way that, you know, is accessible to people who aren't familiar with this book. Because I thought obviously it's just that you push people out of the circle, but there's obviously other ways you can eliminate people. There's tricks you can pull to throw people off balance and throw them off and gain advantages. And it's kind of fun as you see, as I said, this ragtag band slowly gain the respect for the sport and bond together as a team as they take on their rivals, who are all like real dedicated training gyms for sumo, and this bunch are just like a bunch of ragtag amateurs at best who are just being cobbled together. Yeah.
We've got the guy who really does love sumo but shite at it. We've got and he's been there for 8 years.
He's also got a weak stomach. So his running joke is he constantly fouls himself.
Yes, he gets nervous and has diarrhea. And of course he's only wearing the Yes. We've got our lead character, I guess, who's basically they're sort of ending their, I think it's high school, university. So I'm guessing he's in his early 20s, something like that. And he's about to go off and he's got a job. His uncle's got him a job at this big company.
Yes, he is.
Yeah, his the professor that has to sort of sign off his thesis says, I've never heard of you, don't know who you are. You say you've been in my classes, don't remember you. I'm not basically signing off on your degree. But if you go and do the sumo for 3 months, and just because you just need to get enough people to keep the club going to the end of the semester.
That's right, because Professor Aniyama, he views sumo with like this poetic flair. He's like, I think he's Oro.
Well, he's an ex grand champion. Isn't
That's
he?
Right,
he's...
and he quotes like Oro's musings on sumo. It's like written in this like poetic verse of like men built like cathedrals, and he has this real sort of
Jean Cocteau. He's speaking French at the beginning, isn't he? It's I didn't know this was a thing, but French philosophers loved sumo, but there we go.
There's a number of books. I mean, there's him and there's like Orwell, and they wrote books about like traveling to places, and it wouldn't just be like touristy sort of places. They visit like asylums and prisons and just like these really odd places. And
Wigan Pier.
And he wrote about sumo, which is like how this professor views it. And he's got such this love of this sumo club that he belongs to that he basically says to Shuei that, you know, if you go and like revive this club, then, you know, we'll sign you off. And what follows is him recruiting just random people from around the campus.
There's some overweight kid.
Oh, herself. How's it going?
Yeah, so there's an overweight kid. There's his brother who was already in the wrestling club. And in there's a couple of things that this film gets demerits for. Is that there's a bit of homophobia going on because he's set up to be a transvestite, as they say.
Yes.
That's his wrestling act. So, and there's another one later on where Shuei gets called a fruit, which I believe is a slang for homosexual. By the leaders of the alumni of the sumo society, because he's got an earring in. So yeah, his brother turns up. Who else turns up?
Oh, you got the English George footballer Smiley,
a rugby player, isn't he? That is somehow at a Japanese university. Has got perfect Japanese, but he's too poor and like sleeps. doesn't have any power or lights on. He keeps the curtains closed so people can't find him, and he refuses to wear. He wants to wear undershorts as well, doesn't he? But he's interesting. And then there is
you got the football player that they originally tried to recruit called Refrigerator.
Yeah.
And
that is such a 90s reference.
He has his own troop of cheerleaders that follow him around. We've got Masako, who's a large overweight girl who got a bit of a thing for Haru and volunteers to be the manager.
Yes. And I think, yeah, and then there's a couple of other girls sort of floating. You know, there's a romantic sub story between Shuei and somebody. But yeah, Masako is a really interesting character for me. And I think that's what kind of elevates this up a bit, because again, he's poking at things. He pokes at you know, most Japanese girls in Japanese films are little attractive, skinny little things. And the actress who plays Masako is, she's not just large, is she? She's a big girl. And she's also, in a way, she has a romantic story. She has the balls to, basically, she ends up pretending to be a boy to fight in it. And it could be quite humiliating, couldn't it, that visual? But I think it's just excellent that in a Japanese film, you get that kind of poking against sort of those gender norms. I'm getting 92, I'm not sure these things are in people's vocabulary. And we've often talked, haven't we, about how Asian cinema's a bit behind the curve in some of the more, I don't want to call it political correctness, but you know what I mean. We often talk about, well, yeah, but in Hong Kong, they don't quite see things in the same way as we do. So it just seems very progressive. They also, the chubby boy, to go back on what I've just said about the girl, he's a Christian as well, which is a very rare thing. Yeah, so he's actually a religious. So again, that plays into his story as well. That's what I like about these are, although they're not terribly deep characters, they are really interesting. Just calling them ragtag, it doesn't really explain that they are quite different. And they do bond. And they bond rather quickly.
Yeah, I think this is the real appeal of these movies, especially the underdog tales, is seeing how a team like go from being a disorganized mess to slowly coming together as a team and hopefully triumphing over the super team that obviously is dominating the league. And I think once you kind of have this idea of how it's going to go, and unfortunately the film doesn't have that sort of Hollywood styling where you have like the rousing music and they build things up, and we get to like the end, and where you would normally have like the dad character giving the son the thumbs up because he's finally accepted the fact his son wants to be a sumo wrestler, some nonsense like that. Instead, we have the professor going, "Even if you lose, you tried your best." And I'm thinking, that's true inspiring, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, he's kind of, throughout, until the very sort of final act, he is very like, he doesn't want, you know, he obviously was a great sumo, but I don't think he was a superstar, but obviously locally he was a big deal. And he doesn't even want to coach them, does he? Yeah, they just need to, as long as they try. They don't love sumo like they should.
He's very philosophical. As I said, this is the thing, because he's all about philosophy and that. And so his stance is sort of like, it'll happen if it happens. It's like, the fact you're there means that we can keep the sumo club open. And because it's just the fact he's like playing, when there's, for myself, like the first half of the film is the best. Because the jokes are coming like thick and fast, especially as this sort of like foreign world to them. So they're all getting used to the sumo dress and the and one of them's trying to figure out how to go to the bathroom and
how do I do it? He comes out and he's just sort of poke like, it out the side.
He's sort of like, I sewed it, and he just like goes nuts at him because they can't wash him. And then they mix up their ceremonial garb, which they haven't been able to wash either. And my favourite scene is they come to the stop when they're trying to recruit new members. And you've got Shuei being stuck in this sumo garb. And he's just like, they're just sitting outside in front of this table. And like, they have the wrestling couple who've got like the hot ring girl who basically goes up and down the strip to like attract people to their matches and stuff. So.
And yeah, and they're just out there in their...
He's just there and his sumo garb, and like nobody wants to joke because they just look like complete weirdos.
Yeah, it's funny. So yeah, I get what you mean. The film does sort of wants to get the gang together, and we end up with a sort of a couple of, well, there's a very funny initial contest where they're just shit at it and they get beaten in by the world's worst team.
Because they're like local high schoolers or something that beat
them. Yeah, and they are even more pathetic than our guys. It's just that they've got a vague idea, they know what they're doing. And then we get into a more serious match, and it comes together, and then there's a bit of a bit of event happens, and then they turn out, oh no, you've got another one tomorrow. They get really excited, they're delighted, they've won the first match for Well, clearly for at least 8 years. They've been relegated years ago, weren't they? And they never thought they were going to get promoted again. They've somehow win their regional Division 3 tournament. And then they're absolute hammered and having a huge laugh. And then they get told, oh, no, you've got to go. You've got to have another match tomorrow for the promotion battle. But that one, I never doubted they would win the promotion match. And that to me, that was the one downer is to me, is that I kind of wish they hadn't succeeded.
Yeah.
And that would have matched what the feeling of the film was, you know, just try.
Do we know why Smiley refuses to take his shorts off? Because I'm sure I missed this.
I was going to ask you as well. So, yeah, so Smiley refuses not to wear... So he's a big ginger rugby playing lad. Like I say, we can speak Japanese perfectly well. And first off, he's a dick, isn't he? Because he says, well, I'm the best by default. I don't need to train, which doesn't really match any... I don't understand why he would think like that.
It's because he's coming from a sporting background. Yeah. He plays rugby.
But he must have to work at rugby. He has to do training to be good at rugby. The attitude doesn't make any sense. He's called George Smiley, which isn't that from Smiley's People or something? But yes, but he wants to wear undershorts, you know, which again is fairly common. But he isn't allowed to wear them in competition, and so he sits out all his matches until the point where he needs to do it, and then he rips them off, and you think, "Oh, we're going to find out why," and nothing happened. He's just embarrassed, I think, to show his buttocks. But I was expecting there to be a big tattoo on there or something, or he'd be outrageously hairy or something underneath there. But no, he was just shy, which was a bit weird.
I didn't particularly like his character anyway.
I didn't need it. It didn't add anything, unless there's some meta commentary that I wasn't grasping at the time. And even at the end, he goes off back to London, but he's going to come back in 2 years. I was like, why? It just didn't make any sense. But yeah, he was my least favourite.
When we obviously get into the sumo matches themselves, as I said, these aren't like what you see on the television, where it's like the two big guys just like charging at each other. Instead, it's just basically you're watching two overweight guys basically just try and push each other over. There's no amazing special move or anything
Incredibly skinny guys like what's his brother called? Is it Hasaku? Yeah, he's like tiny, but he's apparently really good. He gets really into the whole thing. Oh yeah, and there's another sort of subplot, isn't there, where sort of the local television station's got behind them.
Yes, they become like local heroes, don't they?
Yeah, idols. So it has a little poke at idol culture as well. I love the bit in the girl that's the sort of lead anchor for the television station gets so into it when they win. Oh my God, we've won a match! And Skinny, the director, has to calm her down. I chuckled all the way. And I don't think I laughed out loud at anything, but I chuckled all the way through. I really enjoyed it.
Oh, I wasn't laughing out loud in that. As I said, that first half.
Yeah.
It's just once it settles down in the second half and becomes more about the actual sumo contest. As I said, because you're basically watching amateurs do sumo, it obviously has that level. So when someone gets like thrown or something like that happens, that was kind of exciting. Because it is still obviously the sight of like a big guy hitting the ground like a sack of meat, which is always rewarding. And I was like, it did lead me onto a little bit of a YouTube rabbit hole where I was like watching most brutal moments in sumo, and it's like you see guys who like get knocked down. I'm thinking, yeah, you're getting hit by basically a brick wall of a man, and if you're not right, then he is gonna knock you down. But when you see those guys like fall over, and it's kind of like seeing an egg The legs just like stick up in the air. It's all like, it's kind of amusing.
I mean, yeah, I mean, obviously in America they have a collegiate wrestling is a big deal, isn't it, as well, sort of, which is more sort of Greco-Roman style, boys in leotards writhing around on the floor.
I always wish I could have done that, but we don't.
It's not. We just don't culturally have wrestling in that sense. The wrestling we have was Dickie Davis, bless his heart, who passed away the other week, on World of Sport on ITV, Sunday 12 till 5. Big Daddy, Giant Haystacks, and grannies in the front row.
Oh, you're talking about World of Sport wrestling, aren't you, now?
I am. Yep. But that is the only cultural wrestling that we had in this country. Obviously, in the 90s and so on, American WWF and WWE has made a thing. And, you know, it's all over our channels now. But I think wrestling as a martial art, I guess it's a martial art, is not a big thing here, other than those performative styles of wrestling.
Yeah, it is. As I said, it is a performative art. We don't have the Roman Greco wrestling, which, as I said, is something that much like hockey, I wish that it had been offered to me in school. I think I would have been good at it, because, you know, I was barrel shaped.
Field hockey, you mean, or ice hockey?
Field hockey, ice hockey. Yeah. I just like hockey.
We did field hockey. But that's because when I was at school in 1988, England won the hockey Olympic gold medal, and our teacher was part of that squad. So he made us. The girls all played hockey, but they allowed the boys to do it.
Yeah, the girls
well.
Always got to play hockey, which I was always really sort of envious of. And
no, I enjoyed hockey. I preferred it to football. It's fucking dangerous, giving 11-year-olds giant sticks and balls as hard as stones. Yeah.
So, sadly, my wrestling career didn't go. So instead, my time was spent watching World of Sport and learning of legends like Steven Regal and Robbie Brookside and Rollerball.
Kendo Rockwell. Nagasaki. That was the
Kendo
other one.
Kendo Nagasaki, yes.
Yep.
But we had the ceremonial mask burning.
Yeah. I was just very sad because, like I say, Dickie Davis died last week in our time. Obviously, he'll have died a couple of months ago when you get to hear this. But yes, at the same time as John Motson. And I was actually more sad about Dickie Davis because, I don't know, this is something about 70s TV. That's the sport we watched. That and, oh, dear. But yes, that's two sport deep dive sport references, one from the 70s, one from the 90s, we've had to do with wrestling. But it's just weird. It's just not culturally with us, and you'd have thought it would have been. Anyway.
So, I mean, for myself, I mean, I would still recommend it. It's not the easiest film to find. The reason I did choose it is, as I say, it's much like Swing Girls. It just randomly turned up on YouTube, and I thought, well, we better cover it now because we don't know how long it's going to be there for. So,
yeah, what I would say is, yeah, if you enjoyed Swing Girls, you'll probably enjoy this, right? It's very much like, you know, if Shinobu Yaguchi, who's the director of Swing Girls and Waterboys, had made this, I wouldn't have been surprised. I mean, if you want to watch a film about boys doing a sport that they really shouldn't be doing, in Waterboys, it's synchronized swimming. I think that's funnier and better. But I really enjoyed this. And I will, like you say, finding it. I mean, I happen to have a copy for other reasons, but
there's a region free reasons. Release you can get off Amazon. When I did check on there, and I think that there's a region 1 release floats up, but as far as I'm aware, it's never had a region 2.
No, mine's a Yes Asia region 3 purchase.
So that'd be a good place to start then.
Yeah, but the thing about that is that's a rabbit hole that costs you lots of money when it gets imported. They may not be that expensive. And you have to check with Japanese ones that they're going to have an English subtitle as well. But yeah, and it's, you know, it's 1 hour and 45 minutes. I thought it breezed along, to be honest with you.
Yeah,
and
definitely does.
And I really enjoyed it. And it was the highlight of my week, to be honest with you.
I'm so happy about that. Anything else you want to talk about?
I don't think so. Cool. I don't think so.
So that brings us to the end of tonight's episode. Thank you, as always, for listening. If you haven't done already, please do hit the like and subscribe button wherever you happen to be listening to us. Leave us a review, as it all helps raise the profile of the show. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. Come say hi to us there. And, you know, check out our blog, which is asiancinemafilmclub.wordpress.com, which has got our complete archive episodes. We've got the Anthony Wong month. We've got the Takashi Miike month. We've got the chapter-by-chapter breakdown of Battle Royale. All that good stuff is there, including reviews as well. And, yes. Stephen, it is your turn to choose next. What would you like to go with?
Well, you know what? You did a bit of a deep dive choice this time. I'm just going to go for one of the obvious films that I can't believe we haven't spoken about yet. I think we've got a few sacred cows, haven't we, that we're kind of avoiding, or we might say that we're saving up for an anniversary episode. But I think this is one we sort of talked around. It's probably come up in our thoughts around Halloween and stuff like that. But I've decided it's time for us to look at the original Ring, because I think that's probably one of the films that started us on this journey, right? It's one of those, you know, it's there in that original J-horror boom. And I thought it would be interesting. Now there's, you know, it's fairly easily available, and I think there's even a blooming ultra HD version of it come out now. So let's have a look at Ring, or Ringu as people call it.
They really love to call it Ringu, but when it obviously when it first came out, it was just The Ring.
No, it is just Ring, right? Ringu is what Japanese people say. That's how they, because they don't have the G sound. So that's
how this is why people call, like, say, Gojira when they talk about the original Godzilla. It's just Godzilla. Not Gojira. Yeah. It's just Godzilla over here.
It's just, Ringu is because Japanese, that's how they say the G sound. But no, it's just Ring. But yes, anyway, I thought, let's get one of the sacred cows out. And, you know, I was thinking about one of the sequels, but I thought that would just be a bit too random.
We'll certainly talk about the sequels, certainly, because there's a whole spin-off to be had just talking about the sequels.
Yeah, there's about 13 films we could talk about, but let's go back to the start.
I remember someone sending me an email once that they had been doing an article, and they were like writing about all the Ring movies, and they said, "I have now got a profound fear of water, but beer is okay." So that's obviously coming up in our next show, but thank you as always for listening. Thanks to my co-host Stephen.
Pleasure as always.
And we will be back next time to talk about Ring.昨日のコーヒーは忘れて、昨日のあの子は忘れて、踊り続けていたい夜なのさ。月が砕け散っても、星が燃えて落ちても、踊り続けていたい夜なのさ。胸に刺さった恋は忘れて、昨日のあの子は忘れて、踊り続けていたい夜なのさ。
This podcast is a proud member of the LAMB Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.